and clear your debt of every single thing that you did between these two blessed months of the previous year and then of this year. And of course, it's not something that a person just enters into the holy month of Ramadan, and everything that happened between this month and the last month, that is the last holy month of Ramadan, is all forgiven and forgotten. No, it is a person needs to go up and make effort. It has to be that this Shahr Ramadan, where he is in at this moment in time, is truly a kafara and a recompense for the Shahr Ramadan that he, or rather that which happened between the previous Shahr Ramadan and this one. That he is truly regretful of what he done. He is truly wants to reform himself and truly wants to get onto another path, that is the path towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And as we've seen from the words of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, that this is one of the subuls of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that if he steps forth onto this path of the holy month of Ramadan and performs its haq and refrains from breaking its hurma, he will be of those who have recompensed everything between the 2 months. And he will be of those who are steadfast. And hopefully, inshallah, after this holy month of Ramadan, he'll be of those who are truly steadfast towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to truly make us of those who recompense our misdoings, our lapses from the previous month of Ramadan to this one. Inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no
debate.
We have made some progress, but there's still a long way to go. That has been the prognosis of the talks pretty much since it began in Vienna. One stance, however, has been held and not changed, and that is Iran's insistence that all sanctions be removed. Meanwhile, the U.S. is still struggling to accept that while it continues with the negotiations. In this edition of the debate, we will look at what these sanctions are and why the U.S. is reluctant to accept what Iran sees as a deal maker or a deal breaker.
Signatories of the Iran nuclear deal end their 5th session in 2 weeks amid efforts to revive the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. 2 working groups have been formed, one to draft a list of measures that need to be taken by Iran, and another to outline the sanctions that have to be removed by the U.S. Now a 3rd expert group will be working on the matter of sequence. Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, said that would be the focus of talks when they resume next week.
Next week, the most important question is to talk about the sequence, because we have already talked about measures, and we have now focused more on the question of sequence to make sure that the U.S., who has left the JCPOA, should come back first, should lift all its sanctions first, and then Iran would follow after the verification.
Although no direct talks have taken place between Iran and the U.S., the American delegation has been engaged in discussions with the other parties, including Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China.
The top priority remains to focus on sanction lifting. In this particular context, the U.S. must lift all its sanctions, may it concern Iran or any third party, in thorough, complete, and straightforward manner.
Before leaving Vienna for Tehran, Araghchi said Iran does not want to prolong the negotiations, but also needs to take the time to work on every single word that's being drafted to come up with a specific formula allowing both Iran and the US to come back to full compliance. Iran says the talks are on the right track and moving forward, but as the EU coordinator put it, there's still a lot of work to be done. Pomalevsky, Vienna.
For our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, we have Fouad Azadi, university professor and political analyst, who joins us. We also have Said Mohsen Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator, who joins us from London. I'd like to welcome you both. Fouad Azadi, let me first start with you. Our reporter there ended it with there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. Another statement that we've heard, we have made some progress, but there's still a ways to go. So we're left confused here, and we're hoping that you could perhaps enlighten us as to what is going on in Vienna and whether there has been progress or not, and in what form or manner.
Right. I don't blame you for being confused. This is a manufactured confusion. The issue is not that complicated. What Iran needs is to be able to sell oil, and Iran needs to get that money inside the country. It's that simple. And the reason the American side is engaging in this type of behavior, making things complicated, confusing things, demanding things that has nothing to do with Iran's nuclear program, is because they don't want to do what I just said. They don't want to let Iran sell oil, and they don't want Iran to be able to get that money back. And their level of dedication to the issue of human rights is at the level of not even allowing Iran to use its own money to buy corona vaccines. And at the same time that they talk about human rights, they engage in this type of anti-human behavior. So unfortunately, in the new U.S. government, we basically see the same war crimes mentality that the U.S. officials get to have once they enter the White House, and probably they have that mentality before and after their White House tenure. And that is the basic problem. So in order not to do what they need to do, which is let Iran sell oil and let Iran get the money, they create this the atmosphere of confusion, and unfortunately we have the European countries that are following that line, and that's why we are at the situation that we are.
Yeah, so Said Mohsen Abbas, you know, we hear what Professor Azadi has said there. At the same time, we know that there's been a number of meetings that have taken place. There are explanations that are given by the Iranian side that basically say the only path for the U.S. is to, for rejoining the JCPOA, is full compliance, the removal of all sanctions, which includes the Obama-era sanctions, the sanctions restored by Trump, the additional sanctions in the Trump era, labeled as non-nuclear and whatnot. But basically, the U.S. is still, it appears that they just want to come back with categorizing the sanctions, dividing the sanctions, maybe keeping the human rights ones, human rights issues that it says Iran is violating, which goes maybe contrary to what our Professor Azadi said, because some understanding there is out there that the U.S. will keep the human rights sanctions, but will maybe allow, we don't know any of this yet, but maybe allow the oil to go through. It's really, again, confusing. Let me hear your take on what is going on.
Well, I think, first of all, I have to contextualize the JCPOA within the actual broad objectives of the United States in the Middle East. And, of course, none of those objectives are ones which the Islamic Republic of Iran is going to comply with. And therefore, the JCPOA becomes really, for me, quite a kind of red herring. It's a sort of a sideshow, a distraction in many ways, because you know, the things that America wants really is regime change. They fundamentally, at the core of their policy, are committed to the Islamic Republic of Iran's government collapsing, and they want to try and impose some sort of secular neoliberal establishment, which would, of course, then comply with everything they do in terms of their global systemic rape and pillage and other one. And that's absolutely clear. There's nothing that's changed on that front. So that's the first thing to note, that they will do nothing which will allow the Islamic Republic of Iran's current government to become more powerful or stronger. So as my colleague pointed out, the oil issue becomes very critical. The financial wheeling and dealing of Iran and its ability to generate funds or operate normally in the economies of the world is central to their pillar of destruction of the current government. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that they don't want any interference by the Islamic Republic of Iran in West Asia in terms of its regional development. So, for instance, Israel has been appointed as their policeman. Israel is the one that is allowed to expand and to overrun and operate through puppet regimes like the Saudis, like, of course, even in Jordan, for instance, in Egypt. All of these regimes, these Arab regimes, have long since been really just proxies of Israel and America. So maintaining that status quo is really important for them. And of course, Iran's independent model, an example, its kind of moral stance on so many issues around fighting for the oppressed and giving people their sovereignty, their independence in that region, genuine sovereignty, all goes absolutely against the Americans. And of course, finally, it's the Iranian technological and other scientific developments, I think, which are really troubling both Israel and America, which are also influencing what they're doing around the JCPOA. So the technological developments, largely in the nuclear field, in the ballistic missiles field, and in other drone technology, the military field particularly, troubles them. Of course, Iran's expanded on all sorts of levels in other ways as well, in terms of knowledge and advancing their own capabilities for being self-sufficient. But you see, therefore, what you're seeing with the JCPOA is really just part of a wider, range of problems they have with Iran. These problems won't go away by settling the JCPOA, either for Iran or for the United States. So I do rather feel that this is all just an excuse, and the way they're dragging their feet and delaying and making all these complications seems to me to be more of what they've done before, bluff, bluster, and trying to buy time to work out more ways to destroy Iran.
Okay, buying time is something that is one of the red lines, Professor Izadi, that Iran's leader has set for these talks, and I'm sure that the Iran negotiating team is abiding by that, which is led by Abbas Araghchi. But I'm trying to ask from you, Professor Izadi, to again clarify the news that's out there, because there are many who are forming their conclusions or their ideas about what is going on in these talks by what they're hearing in the news. Now, this is one of them that Iran has rejected. The source is saying, according to sources close to European and U.S. negotiators, Mali is expected to offer Tehran a Goldilocks-style deal. This comes from Foreign Policy. Just enough sanctions relief so Iran will return to the pact, but not so much that it would leave Biden vulnerable to attacks from hardliners at home, including those in his own party who oppose any concessions at all to Iran. Iran has rejected that. Why is this? Why is there this type of news that's coming out, do you think?
I think the Biden administration doesn't want to comply with JCPOA. So a few minutes ago, Jake Sullivan talked on a news channel in the United States saying that the United States is interested in compliance for compliance. But when you read these type of news reports and analysis in the American media, you realize that Jake Sullivan and Rob Malley and others that deal with this issue in the U.S. government, they are not telling you the truth. Because if they were really interested in complying with JCPOA, they didn't need to wait 3 months and engage in this type of prolonged negotiations. They could do to JCPOA what they did with the Paris Climate Accord, just issue an executive order the way Biden did in the first week of his presidency, and the United States returned to that accord. And that's when you actually want to comply with an agreement, and that's the way you do it. And if you don't want to comply with an agreement, you start playing around with words, and you create confusion as you started your program with that idea. And you know, saying that we have people in the U.S. Congress that oppose JCPOA, so we are not going to comply with JCPOA, is not an excuse. The internal power struggles in the United States, internal competitions between Republicans and Democrats, is not an Iranian problem. That's an internal issue for the United States. The U.S. Agreed to comply with JCPOA in 2015, said that it's one of the P5 plus one countries that is accepting the terms of JCPOA, and now, after 5 years, with the Trump administration trying to destroy JCPOA, the new administration in Washington suddenly remembers that there are people in the U.S. Congress that don't like JCPOA. So having this type of excuses, I don't think is going to fly, and Iran's legitimate demand is that the agreement needs to be followed, and they have a choice to follow the agreement, and they can actually do comply with the agreement, and Iran has said that the Iranian government will be the same, or they can make confusion. It's a choice that they have. Either way, I think Iranian government is confident that even without an agreement with the United States, the country can continue to grow and become stronger, and realizing that there is no difference between Republicans and Democrats when it comes to regime change issues, as your guest in London referred to, is going to be quite beneficial for a lot of Iranians that do see a difference between these two parties when it comes to their aim with regard to Iran. They do have differences in how engage in tactics, but in terms of their ultimate goal, I don't see a difference, and that idea is going to be accepted by a lot of people in Iran if the Biden administration continues on the same path that they have started.
Okay, I'm going to come back to you with another piece after I ask our guest, Seymour Sanabas, my next question, but I'm going to come back to you, Professor Azadi, with another piece of news out there that Iran has rejected in the past 48 hours. Okay, Seymour Sanabas, so a simple question comes out of what you said. If the U.S. is after regime change in Iran, what is it doing at the negotiating table then with at this point with E4? I mean, it should just come out, but yet we're seeing these negotiations go on.
Well, by continuing these talks, as I said, what they're going to do is really try to distract, try to slow Iran down, also create confusion, ideally, amongst the Islamic Republic of Iran's population. You see, if you get a debate going by keeping these things, try to make the Islamic Republic of Iran's leadership look perhaps as though it's incalcitrant, it doesn't want to negotiate, and it's bringing hardship on its own people. This is the narrative that they've been pushing by putting the economic sanctions ever more tightly and ever more expansively. They want to try and convince also the grassroots population to say, look, we're fed up of all these sanctions. Why don't we just compromise and go for the deal, which at least gets us back into the American good books? Well, the thing is, the problem with that, of course, is that it won't satisfy the Americans or the Israelis. What you're going to do is you give away one element, and they're going to want more and more and more. This is the nature of the imperialist beast. It's a fact of life that they're looking for the vulnerability and the weakness within Iran. If they were being truly fair, what the Americans would be looking on this table is that Iran is willing to forego its nuclear, even its peaceful nuclear development, essentially. And what they're also getting out of the deal, if they were to go for it, is the fact that actually they're not being brought into any kind of denuclearization package in West Asia, at least, if not beyond. I mean, what principally should happen is that Israelis who have nuclear capability, who are the main problem in the Middle East for peace, are being allowed to have a carte blanche, and they should, they're not being given special JCPOA-style deals. Why is that not happening? I mean, of course, Israel is the fundamental problem in that region. They're not being asked to come in front of an inquisition. Why is Iran particularly being picked out? Iran hasn't done anything that really validates even the idea of a JCPOA agreement coming into the equation. Then, of course, there's the proxy, the other proxy, Saudi Arabia. The Americans have given a complete green light to their own nuclear development agencies and corporate companies to go in and actually develop nuclear capability in Saudi Arabia. Those tenders are out. It's public knowledge. So on the one hand, you've got an attitude towards the Islamic Republic of Iran where you're trying to bind them down in a deal which now you've reneged on, walked out unilaterally, and are still dragging your feet and doing economic terrorism as a result of it for your own gains. But on the other side, in the same region, you're allowing nations like Saudi Arabia, who are obviously antagonistic to the Islamic Republic of Iran, you're actually financing and supporting their development of nuclear weapons, potentially. And, of course, the despotic regimes there are not under question.
Okay. So, Professor Izadi, I talked about how I'm going to ask you about the second piece of news out there in the past 48 hours that's come out that, if you can clarify for us, this comes from Reuters, how it said Iran and world powers have made some progress on how to revive the 2015 nuclear accord. No news there. Later abandoned by the U.S. and an interim deal could be a way to gain time for a lasting settlement. And they have said that Iranian officials have said that. Now, Iran's top nuclear negotiator, Abbas Araghchi, has said that there is no discussion on an interim agreement or similar topic in the Vienna talks. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, one issue that is the elephant in the room is Iran's election, a presidential election in June. And we have this situation internally that there are people who may want to use these type of negotiations as a sort of a winning card in the debates that the country will have when people decide to choose the next president in Iran. So having an interim agreement is going to be attractive on political for political reasons. That is in line with the election that is coming up. But I don't think, since you asked my opinion, I don't think this is going to work out. I think given the experience of JCPOA in 2015, given the fact that even the Obama administration did not follow JCPOA properly when they were in office until January of 2017. I don't think the Iranian leadership, the country's leadership, will go with a project or a scheme that is designed to basically affect the results of Iran's election. The result is going to be, if the Americans continue on the current path, is that we are not going to have an agreement, and these talks will fail if the Biden administration continues with its current line of thinking.
Thank you very much for that. It was a pleasure. Fouad Izadi, university professor and political analyst. You answered many questions. We do appreciate that. Of course, Said Mohsen-Abbas, your analysis. Thank you very much. Journalist and political commentator there from London. Many thanks to you both. And that does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitaly, the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye. Yeah.
The month of Allah presents Ahkam, Islamic Commandments of Fasting by Hujjatul Islam Khak Daman.
Hello and welcome to our program. This is Month of Allah, and I am happy to be with you another time to talk about the remaining ahkam in month of Ramadan. This time I'm going to talk about a new concept, which I'm going to first describe it, and then afterwards that we learn this term, talk with this term. It's called kafar, which in English we refer to it as atoning for something, all right? So in month of Ramadan, as you know, some excuses will be happening for some people that they can break their fasts, right? If the excuses are acceptable, then it is all right. After the month of Ramadan, you should fast one day for each day that you have canceled your fasting. But if the excuses are not acceptable, it means you need to atone for your fasting. It means you have to do something to make up for it, to kind of compensate for it. So this is the meaning of kafar. So from now on, I'll be talking more about this concept, and I will be naming the term. I'll say kafar. All right. Okay. So when this happens, sometimes people don't know that if they do a couple of activities, it will break their fast. Like they don't know throwing up breaks their fasting. It's all right. If they didn't know, their fast is all right. They forgot, for example, in the middle of fasting that this is the period they shouldn't eat something. So they eat something, and after an hour, they wake up, they remember that this is the month of Ramadan, I shouldn't have eaten something. So they come back to their senses because they have forgot, it's all right. But if intentionally and deliberately somebody does these forbidden activities in month of Ramadan, so the example is, you know that you shouldn't eat, you eat. You know that you should not have intercourse, you have intercourse with your wife. You know that you should not throw up, you throw up. Or you eat something that you know is not compatible with your stomach and it makes you throw up. So if you don't know this, you should atone for it. And kafara becomes necessary for you. This is the first thing and first point to make. The second point is those people who commit haram in month of Ramadan, even though they don't think that this haram may break the fast. Those who commit haram, like, you know, putting lies on the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them all, or the other haram, like, you know, drinking wine. So what is this kafar that we have talked about this episode? Well, for each fast that you have invalidated, you have canceled, you have broken, for each fast, you have a couple of options that if you do one of them, the others will be not necessary to do. So one of them is necessary. So for each fast, if you deliberately break it, you need to either fast 60 days, the 30 days of, you know, like half of it, should be consecutive, one after each other. The second half doesn't need to be consecutive. Or if you cannot fast for 60 days, you need to feed 64 people or give them food. What is the amount of this food? We say one mod, which is like 750 grams of food. By food here, we mean regular food, which are regularly and very popularly eaten by people, most of people, like bread, like, you know, wheat, like grains, like date, you know, and food like this. Or if you cannot do it. So fasting for 60 days, half of it consecutive, the other half, it doesn't matter, you can fast them consecutively or no, with pauses in between of them, with some people, some days off. Or giving food to 60 people. Now, each one person counts. You cannot give, for example, 2 kilos of bread to one person and to the other person you don't give something. No. Every person counts for one. So when we say you need to atone for 60 people, you need to give them food, 60 people. Each person needs to receive 750 grams at least of food, regular food that we named before. So this is the concept of a kafara, the atonement that you need to have if you deliberately break your fasting. In next episode, I'll be talking about the different details that are regarding our matter. Thank you so much and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Around the world with reporters.
Signatories of the Iran nuclear deal end their fifth session in 2 weeks amid efforts to revive the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. Two working groups have been formed, one to draft a list of measures that need to be taken by Iran and another to outline the sanctions that have to be removed by the US. Now a third expert group will be working on the matter of sequence. Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, said that would be the focus of talks when they resume next week.
Next week, the important question is to talk about the sequence, because we have already talked about measures, and we have now focused more on the question of sequence to make sure that the U.S., who has left the JCPOA, should come back first, should lift all its sanctions first, and then Iran would follow after the verification.
Although no direct talks have taken place between Iran and the U.S., the American delegation has been engaged in discussions with the other parties, including Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China.
The top priority remains to focus on sanction lifting. In this particular context, the U.S. must lift all its sanctions, may it concern Iran or any third party, in thorough, complete, and straightforward manner.
Before leaving Vienna for Tehran, Araghchi said Iran does not want to prolong the negotiations, but also needs to take the time to work on every single word that's being drafted to come up with a specific formula allowing both Iran and the U.S. to come back to full compliance. Iran says the talks are on the right track and moving forward, but as the EU coordinator put it, there's still a lot of work to be done. Homolinsky, Vienna.
Tensions between the United States and Russia appear to be ratcheting up in recent weeks over a range of issues, including Ukraine. The Russian Defense Ministry on Tuesday accused the U.S. and NATO of engaging in what it described as provocative activities in the waters and airspace of the Black Sea. Moscow also accused Kiev of trying to destabilize the situation in the eastern Donbass region. Amid escalating tensions, Washington and its NATO allies have rallied behind Kiev. They voiced concern over Russia's troop deployment along its borders with Ukraine, claiming Russia might be planning to invade the country. But Moscow said the military buildup was in response to calls threatening military action by NATO and nothing more. Washington-Moscow tensions heightened after the U.S. administration announced a new array of anti-Russia sanctions last Thursday. The White House claimed the sanctions were in retaliation for a range of Russia's actions, including its alleged meddling in the U.S. election, cyber espionage, and action in Ukraine. The Kremlin responded with tit-for-tat measures. But the hostile attitude of the U.S. and its allies is not limited to Russia. They have also collectively formed and launched a pressure campaign against China. Just last month, the U.S., along with the European Union, Britain, and Canada, imposed coordinated actions on Beijing under the pretext of human rights violations. The United States and China have also been embroiled in disputes over a host of issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. Beijing has time and again accused Washington of seeking to destabilize mainland China by interfering in the affairs of Hong Kong and Chinese Taipei, as well as fomenting tensions in the South China Sea. The country last week escalated its military activities after the U.S. announced it would deploy its warships to the region. The Chinese president on Tuesday also criticized the hegemonic power structures in the global governance, calling for the rejection of such moves.
The future of the world should be mastered by all countries in the world. Rules made by a single country or just a few countries cannot be forcibly applied on others. The world order cannot be led by unilateralism from some country.
The growing tension between Washington on the one side and Moscow and Beijing on the other is bringing the two countries even closer. U.S. President Joe Biden will probably face a nightmare scenario given deepening ties and strategic cooperation between China and Russia, the countries Washington thinks is a threat to its global interests.
Northern Ireland is bracing itself for more potential trouble. Peaceful pop-up protests across the region in the coming days. An opportunity, some say, to catch police by surprise and block major roads for a time. They follow days of riots and violent clashes earlier this month that plunged the city of Belfast and parts of Northern Ireland into a crisis not seen since the dark days of the Troubles that started in the late 1960s and led to nearly three decades of bloodshed.
There will be protests around the north of Ireland, but what's worrying is that there's a lot of disinformation also. What we're seeing here is a hidden hand in trying to raise tensions between the Catholic and Protestant communities. And when we see this, these things happening, we always have to remember that when there's a void there, extremists fill that void. And when the extremists are there to fill that void, we always see the hidden hand of British security services.
Tensions have been rising since Brexit, which many warn would threaten the Good Friday Agreement of 1998 that put an end to the Troubles. The implementation of the Northern Ireland Protocol allowed the UK to leave the EU without setting up a border on the island of Ireland. Instead, the UK and EU agreed to a customs border between Britain and Northern Ireland. Now, the loyalist and unionist communities who wish to remain under British rule are demanding the protocol be scrapped.
This would seriously destabilize the peace and brought us back to somewhere that was pre-1998 and something that we as a society didn't want to see.
The riots were also fueled by the country's police chief's refusal to resign after a decision not to prosecute Sinn Féin politicians for attending a large funeral last year against COVID restrictions.
I don't see why Simon Byrne would have resigned. I think that he gave his report to those that would have made that decision within the PPS. And, you know, it, once he has passed that on, there's not much he can do after that. He made recommendations.
Efforts are underway for a political settlement of tensions, including a call for dialogue among all sides from the U.S. president. Still, fears of more unrest and violence are in the air. Said Barisa, London.
The EU's top diplomat, Josep Borrell, updated the bloc's 27 foreign affairs ministers on the latest state of play regarding talks in Vienna to try and save the Iran nuclear deal. He told them that discussions have become less general and more focused, particularly regarding U.S. sanctions against Iran and the Islamic Republic's nuclear energy program.
I talked with Secretary of State Blinken last week when he was in Brussels. I also talked with Minister Sharif. I think that both parts are really interested in reaching an agreement.
Borrell talks about an agreement, but critics say the EU has been much too soft on the US. After all, an agreement was reached in 2015. It was endorsed by the UN. Only the US broke the terms of the accord when Donald Trump took Washington out of the deal almost 3 years ago.
With Iran, we'll see what happens.
Analysts say in those 3 years, the EU, as coordinator of the deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, failed to stand up to Trump. Representatives from Iran, Russia, China, France, Britain, Germany, and the European Commission are attempting to preserve the accord during negotiations in the Austrian capital. US officials are there on the sidelines of the talks. Given that the nuclear deal is underpinned by UN Resolution 2231, the vast majority of diplomats agree it should be respected.
We are 193 member states of the United Nations. Of course, the United States, as you've rightly pointed out, is a powerful member state, but they are a member state. And so we need to rally the numbers against those that may have different opinions.
Some citizens we've been talking to say Tel Aviv is behind efforts to derail the nuclear agreement.
Israel have interests, and Israel are kind of pushing America.
Frankly, what we need is more peace and not more warmongering.
Tehran insists the only way the issue can be resolved is if Washington lifts all of its illegal sanctions. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Imposed more tight restrictions to fight the spread of the coronavirus. Earlier, Turkish president said that the daily lockdown during the first 2 weeks of the holy month of Ramadan will start at 7 p.m. instead of 9 p.m. The lockdown will last till 5 a.m. every day, as the weekend lockdown will continue with stricter measures and more police officers present in the streets to make sure citizens and residents are abiding by the rules. During the weekend, security forces in all 81 provinces were out to make sure people are not violating the lockdown. Tourists are the only ones allowed to be outside during the lockdowns. In Istanbul alone, some 20,000 policemen took part in this campaign. Turkish Interior Minister threatened to punish those who do not respect the rules.
We will be out with our full force. Foreigners with residency permits are also subjected to restrictions and lockdowns, and they have to obey the rules just like others. I have the authority to revoke the residency permits of those who try to exploit the situation, pretending to be tourists. We will not let this happen.
The death toll in Turkey surged last month when restrictions were relaxed. Some blame the people who didn't act responsibly. Others blame the government for taking decisions based on the economic needs of the country rather than what is better for people's health. Analysts believe the government must take stricter measures. However, it is the economic situation that is preventing it from doing so.
The government is doing its best against the pandemic, but unfortunately the cases are rising because the country cannot afford full closure of businesses. Therefore, semi-closure is the only solution, and people must be more responsible.
Turkish Health Ministry said 20 million vaccine jabs have been distributed across the country. This is as Turkey says it has potentially developed a vaccine that just entered the phase of human trials. Turkish Industry and Technology Minister Mustafa Varank has volunteered for the trials. Turkish government wants to welcome tourists again after the holy month of Ramadan. However, many believe it is still too soon for this step, as only 25% of citizens have been vaccinated. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
After mass scenes of a failed security operation against thousands of protesters demanding the expulsion of French ambassador from Pakistan, the public resentment pitched high when the police launched operation against the protesters in the eastern city of Lahore. At the heart of public outrage is the revoking of a 6-month-old agreement by the government with Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan, or the TLP, a political and religious group. The TLP championed the cause to expel French ambassador over a repeated incident of blaspheming of Muslim Prophet Muhammad and their official patronage by the French government. The TLP supporters allegedly attacked a police station in Lahore and kidnapped 11 policemen, including senior official. Later on, the protesters released all the police officials. The police says an oil tanker with over 50,000 liters of fuel was also taken away by the protesters, which caused ripples within the corridors of power of its possible explosion. A strong public reaction once again forced the government to halt its security operation. There were countrywide wheel jam strike and closure of businesses after many opposition parties and other religious groups announced to support the TLP's demand to expel French ambassador.
How long we would put up with incidents like burning of Holy Quran? How long we would put up with blasphemy being committed against our Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him? But now we have decided not to tolerate it any longer.
Alarmed by public backlash, Prime Minister Imran Khan struggled hard in his live address to the nation to calm down public anger.
When Muslim countries stand up together and collectively boycott trade with France over blasphemy incidents, then it would have an impact. I would lead this campaign internationally now to prevent incidents of blasphemy.
Pakistan banned TLP last week, declaring it a terrorist organization in a country where violence against the police has become a norm by almost all major political parties to press their demands.
The government has resumed negotiation with the TLP, which is not ready to settle down on anything short of the expulsion of French ambassador from Pakistan. Now the TLP seems to be on a far more strong footing after a failed security operation against them. Therefore, analysts believe that the government is also running out of options but to withdraw its decision to ban it. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The factory in the south of Tehran, where a new vaccine named Osvit would be produced within a few months to immune people against the deadly coronavirus. The name is taken from the pharmaceutical company that is developing the vaccine in collaboration with a knowledge-based firm. The joint project will soon be tested on humans to be mass-produced in the capital, Tehran.
Given that the initial phases of the Osvit 19 are completed and the early stages, including the animal phase, were carried out on rats and monkeys successfully, we need to launch this mass production line, and now we are prepared.
I asked the officials whether the formula is imported from other countries or it is indigenous, and this was the answer.
Not even a single word of the 420-page project of the vaccine has been non-native. It's fully developed in Iran. We took samples from the first patients at the beginning of the pandemic. Then it was characterized, inactivated, and cultivated. The job has been a very complicated teamwork and totally indigenous.
Right now, the company is producing the vials, and as the manager said, they can produce up to 6,000 every hour. They also told us that there is a capacity to produce about 20 million doses of the jab in a year. After the official ceremony in which the vial was unveiled, the vice president for science and technology launched the production line.
Within the past few years, very good things have been achieved in the domain of vaccine production in the country. This year, we have several corona vaccines to be mass-produced. This vial production line is a very important infrastructure for other companies that are developing the vaccine.
The Osvit vaccine must be injected in two stages with a three-week interval.
Iran says the second phase of vaccination against COVID-19 will begin in early May, and at this stage, about 15 million people would be vaccinated against the coronavirus. To this end, the country needs about 30 million doses of the vaccine, out of which a great number will be homemade ones. Fuman Abedi, Tehran.
America's longest war in Afghanistan is going to end as Washington has pledged to pull out its forces from the country in 5 months. Apart from other consequences of Washington's war in Afghanistan, casualties caused by the conflict over the past two decades show that almost 90,000 Afghan and U.S. military forces, more than 70,000 civilians, and over 84,000 terrorists have lost their lives since 2001. The main cause behind such casualties is said to be Washington's failures, including taking the Taliban not so seriously. Although weak presence of Taliban was seen in remote villages of Afghanistan in 2001, it slowly expanded its maneuver area to big cities by launching bomb attacks or complex assaults in and after 2005. The attacks mostly claimed the lives of civilians. In response, Afghan and foreign troops launched more military operations, especially air strikes, increasing human losses in the country. Now that Washington has realized there is no military solution to the Afghan war, U.S. President Joe Biden announced on Wednesday that all U.S. troops will leave the war-torn country by September 11, the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. The Afghan government strongly believes that the Taliban will never be able to take control over the country militarily due to high capabilities of Afghan national armed troops in the fight against terrorism.
The Afghan Defense Ministry, in close cooperation with other government bodies, is fully ready to confront the worst-case scenario. Concerns of some international intelligence agencies are because of the security of their own countries. But we are not worried because we are now capable enough to defend our nation.
Meneher also argued that the only way to put an end to bloodshed in Afghanistan is the establishment of a united front by Afghan people without being dependent on foreign players, and convince the Taliban to lay down their arms.
The time has arrived for all Afghans to come together and set aside differences in order to use the ongoing peace process as an opportunity for the country to see peace and stability after decades-long war and violence.
While all players are waiting for the launch of Turkey summit on the Afghan peace process, the Taliban say they are not willing to attend it because the U.S. violated the terms of the agreement signed between the two in Doha, February last year. Based on the Doha agreement, U.S. military forces have to leave Afghanistan by May 1st. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
A show of military might. Different units of the Islamic Republic of Iran's army paraded the forces' latest military equipment on the National Army Day. In Tehran, commanders of the Army's Air Force, Navy, and Ground Force, as well as senior commanders of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, were present to oversee the event. Ahead of the ceremonies, a message from leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, was read out, where he praised the contributions the Army has made to the security of the country. Army officials say serving the Iranian people is their top priority.
In fact, through these parades, we seek to send messages to our nation. We want to tell our people that we will continue to stand with you to ensure your peace and security, just as we have done over the past four decades.
The parades feature the latest military achievements and weaponry of the Iranian army, including radars, tanks, armored vehicles, and fighter jets. The highlight was the latest drones, missiles, and missile systems that are developed inside the country, including Sayyad and Mursad missile systems. The Islamic Republic provides for 80% of its defensive needs domestically. Officials say the country owes this to four decades of arms embargoes imposed on the country by the U.S. and its allies.
What we did in the past four decades was to look at the sanctions as an opportunity to rely on our own resources. We discovered new potentials inside the country, and here we are today producing nearly every essential military equipment, from missiles to UAVs. So today, our security is not tied to foreign arms suppliers.
The National Army Day was designated in 1979, following a historic speech by late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. Back then, he thanked the army for its role in the victory of the Islamic Revolution by announcing its neutrality, as the former Pahlavi regime pushed commanders to suppress the revolution. Every year, this massive parade sends strong messages of security to Iranians and the region. But on top of all the messages, the annual occasion is widely interpreted as the army's renewed support for the Islamic establishment. Where officials say, with or without sanctions, the Iranian armed forces continue to defend the country's sovereignty. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Known that Allama Amini has been regarded as a personality to whom many authorities have been attracted, both Muslim and non-Muslim. I don't say, both Shia and non-Shia, no, both Muslim and non-Muslim.
Allama Amini was an extraordinary scholar who never agreed on a little things. Even when you look at the book Al-Ghadir, and he has other books as well. So it shows his devotion towards Islam, how sincere he was and how much he was very much involved in the knowledge and learning knowledge.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher, and I'm Atta, the host of this program. In this episode, we want to talk about Allama Abdul Hussein Amini, the great author of the book Al-Ghadir. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, two experts, one from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, and another, a faculty member of the University of Qom, Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr Rouhani. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome, and Dr. Fakhrouhani, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum.
So, Dr. Fakhrouhani, let's start with you, brother. We want to talk about Al-Ghadir, the magnum opus of Allama Amini, which was considered and is considered as one of the greatest books I've written on Imam Ali alayhi salam and the event of Ghadir. You yourself have developed a book titled Devoted to the Truth, Allama Amini, the author of Al-Ghadir, published by A Sun Behind the Cloud Publications in Birmingham, Britain. But Dr. Fakhrouhani, talk a little bit about the background of writing the book Al-Ghadir by Allama Amini and his method of research regarding this book. What made Allama Amini significant regarding writing the event of Ghadir and making him different, in fact, because there are also so many other books written on Al-Ghadir event and Imam Ali alayhi salam. But talk a little bit about his scholarly background for us.
Yes. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, al-Nasrin. First of all, we know that all major academic works and, I mean, academic trends, whether in Hawza or in the university, or whether in the West or in the East, great scholars who initiated those programs, okay, and those projects are usually influenced by their own teachers, okay? When Allama Amini was a student in Tabriz, because he was born and raised initially in Tabriz.
That's right. He was a Turk.
Yes.
A Turkish-speaking man.
Yes.
This made him a special too, because for a Turkish-speaking man to write in Arabic.
Yes, Al-Ghadir. In fluent Arabic. Yes, yeah. In beautiful Arabic. Yeah. Yes. When Allama Amini was in Tabriz, he had several great teachers. Mm-hmm. And those teachers that Allama Amini benefited from them, all of them were already great mujtahids, graduated from Najaf or Karbala, mainly from Najaf.
Okay.
Among them, there was a person, there was a personality, whose name was Ayatollah Sayyid Murtaza Khosrow Shahi, the father of this Ayatollah Khosrow Shahi who passed away last year.
Okay.
Yes?
That's right.
This Ayatollah Khosrow Shahi, this Ayatollah Khosrow Shahi's father.
Yes.
Had already written a book in answer to a query regarding the meaning of velaya or superintendentship or superintendentness or guardianship of Imam Ali alayhi salam. In answer to a query he had received from a scholar from Kurdistan, and that scholar was a Sunni great man.
Okay.
When Allama Amini was in Tabriz, he benefited from the lectures of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Murtaza Khosrow Shahi.
Okay.
And he had the opportunity to examine, to study the very manuscript that Ayatollah Khosrow Shahi was developing.
Okay.
Later on, that book was published, first in Arabic, then in Persian translation.
Okay.
So far as I know, that book hasn't been translated into English, okay, although it's a great book in its own terms.
What a mess, okay.
Yes. When Allama Amini went to Najaf, one of his close relatives told me, Allama Amini, he went to Najaf, in two periods.
That's right.
One for the first time for around 8 years, and he became a mujtahid and returned to Tabriz, stayed in Tabriz for less than 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, again, he went to Najaf and never returned, to Tabriz again.
Okay.
In his second phase of staying in Najaf, he never wanted to waste his time in Hawza. He wanted to do something quite significant and historic.
Okay.
Because of this, he appealed to Imam Ali alayhi salam. Mm-hmm. And in one of his pilgrimages to the shrine of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Najaf, this point, the character and career of Imam Ali alayhi salam came to his mind. And it was an eternal flame in his spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the background.
That's
and
right.
the major incentive in Allama Amini to devote not only one book, but his whole life to Imam Ali alayhi
salam. That's all right. Thank you very much, Dr. Farfohani. And that's all right. You know, so many books have been written on Imam Ali alayhi salam, and so many scholars have talked about it. There are still so many manuscripts, but all of a sudden, Allama Amini, we can say, becomes great scholar. Nowadays, so many explanations, elaborations are written on Al-Ghadir. He dedicated really his life to Imam Ali alayhi salam and Al-Ghadir. But why the Ghadir event, Sayyid Mohsen?